Now we bring you the first of three parts of a new classic serial.
We present Rites of Passage by William Golding, adapted for radio by Don Taylor. With Samuel West as Edmund Talbot.
Honored Godfather. With those words, I begin the journal I engaged myself to keep for you. And what words could be more suitable? The place? On board the ship. The date? The first day of my passage to the other side of the world. The Antipodes. I climbed the bulging and towery side of what in her young days may have been one of Britain's formidable wooden walls. I stepped through a kind of low doorway into the darkness of some deck or other. A limping old fellow with a shiny bald pate and bunches of white hair on either side accosted me.
I'm Wheeler, sir, your servant. This here is your cabin.
My good man, what is this stink?
Stink, sir? What stink, sir?
The stink, the fetor, the stench, call it what you will.
Lord, sir, you'll soon get used to that.
I do not want to get used to it. Where's the captain of this vessel?
There's nothing Captain Anderson can do about it, sir. It's sand and gravel, you see. The new ship has iron ballast, but she's older than that. If she was betwixt and between in ages, you might say they'd have dug it out, but she's too old. They wouldn't want to go stirring about down there, sir.
Must be a graveyard, then.
As to that, I can't say, sir, not having been in her previous. Now, you sit there for a bit, and I'll bring you a brandy.
My cabin is a kind of hutch against the ship's side, along which a bunk hangs like a trough, with two drawers beneath it. At one end there is a flap which lets down a writing table, and at the other there is a canvas bowl with a bucket underneath it. There are a dozen such hutches on one side of the ship and another dozen on the other, separated by a narrow lobby, made even narrower by the enormous cylinder of the mizzen mast.
Here's your brandy, sir. We dine in 1 hour's time, sir, at 4 o'clock.
And what is all the noise?
Well, sir, there's sheep and cattle forward, apart from the common passengers, women and children among them, sir. This is the ship's noise.
Almost as bad as the stench, and we're not even underway. I intend to request more ample accommodation.
That will be difficult, sir. Can I suggest you wait a bit?
I'm somewhat indignant, Wheeler, that such an old and decrepit vessel should be used for so long a voyage.
Oh, Lord, sir, she'll float till she sinks. And she was built to be sunk, sir. She's been lying in ordinary with no one but the boatswain and the carpenter on board.
In ordinary?
That's to say in reserve, sir. Up the creek there on a good old hawser. None of these iron chains that rattle like a corpse on the gibbet. None of your copper bottoms either, sir. Pitched within and without, like the oldest vessel of the line.
Are you telling me she's been at anchor like a hulk, with no modern attention to her hull? I'm not surprised. I can see through the deck head above me, and the side is so splintered and patched, it must be a miracle she holds together at all.
But she'll be safer in a blow than many a stiffer vessel, sir.
Safer?
Yes, sir. If we get into a bit of a blow, she'll render like an old boot, soft and easy from long use. You should remove all articles from your chests you'll need on voyage, sir, before they're struck down below.
I must unpack my chests?
Yes, sir. They can't stay here.
I could find no one with the authority to countermand this singularly foolish order, so I had to comply. I've seen little of my fellow voyagers so far. We have some ladies, some older gentlemen, and a rather foolish-looking young parson, and Mr. Prettyman, the Jacobin. It is a secret part of my duty to keep an eye on him. When do we sail?
I reckon the wind will veer in the night, sir, and we shall get away and make sail when the tide turns.
Well, Wheeler, I am a good sailor, you will find.
Oh, are you, sir? I'm very glad to hear it, sir.
And he smiled at me in such a way as to make me resolve to teach him a lesson in manners at the first opportunity. But even as I write these words, the pattern of our wooden world changes. What a thundering and volleying of loosened canvas. What unearthly cries and shrieks. and a signal gun. Our anchor has been plucked out of the soil and gravel of old England, and we are underway. For 3 or maybe 5 years, I shall have no connection with my native soil. And however high I climb, for I must warn your lordship that my ambition is boundless, I shall never forget whose kindly hand set me on the first rung of the ladder. We have been at sea now for a day, and I have spent much of it in the privy house. Your lordship was pleased to recommend that I should conceal nothing. "Tell all, my boy," you said. "Let me live again through you." The devil is in it, then. I have been most confoundedly seasick and kept my bunk. Seneca off Naples was in my predicament. And if a stoic philosopher is reduced by a few miles of lumpy water, what will become of us poor fellows on the higher seas?
Tears,
tears of exhaustion, Wheeler, that's all.
Oh, yes, sir, I'm sure you could hunt all day and dance all night. Now, if you was to put me or any seaman on a horse, our kidneys would be shook clear down to our knees.
Yes, I suppose so. Oh, my God.
But learning to ride a ship, sir, you'll do that soon enough. Have a dose of this, sir.
What is it?
Paregoric, sir. Soon do you ride.
The comfortable taste took me straight back to the nursery and into deep sleep and strange dreams. When I woke, the motion of the ship was sensibly increased. It was thick dark, and I didn't know where I was.
Wheeler! Wheeler, goddamn you!
All right, sir. I'm just
trying to help me out of here. Let's get some air.
Now, you just lie there still for a while, sir, and you'll be right as a tree. I'll sort out a bowl.
Get me out of this stench, Wheeler, goddamn your eyes. Get me outside.
Thing is, sir, we're having a bit of a blow, sir.
Yes.
Your great coat with a triple cape is much too fine a garment for all that flying spray. But I do have a suit of yellow oils, Steve. I bought it for a gentleman who, in the event, never embarked. Yes. You should have it, sir, for no more than I gave for it. Then, if you choose, you can sell it back to me second hand at the end of the voyage.
Yes, Wheeler, whatever. Just get me dressed and out of here. The air's stifling me.
I wish your lordship could have seen me in my yellow suit, India rubber boots and oilskin hat. I must have looked like a sailor, no matter how unsteady I felt. The lobby was alarmingly awash with water, but with Wheeler's help I got out on deck. There was an eye of light showing still, but spray flew over from the high starboard side, and the clouds that raced past us seemed no higher than the masts. Staring up and back, I could see two helmsmen at the wheel, black tarpaulin figures, their faces lit from below as they glanced alternately at the illuminated compass, then up at the set of the sails.
Is that the rest of the convoy? I can just see light.
Yes, Roger!
We have few sails spread. That's the inclemency of the weather, I suppose.
No, sir! It's so we shouldn't run clear away from the rest of the convoy. We have the legs of all but a few, sir. We shall leave them off Hushings and go to Gibraltar with one ship of the line as escort. After that, we proceed alone.
So how shall we avoid capture?
We have a few guns, then, sir. And we look like a warship.
Is this fair or just? Do their lordships realize what a future Secretary of State they have cast upon the waters? However, the die is cast, and I must take my chance.
Who's that crouching figure just come out of the lobby?
It's the parson, I think, yeah.
He's on his knees, but not for his devotions, eh? He looks like he's going to be sick.
But as he tried to stand upright, the ship gave an extra heave, so that he came half running, half flying down the deck, and might have gone clean through the starboard ratlines overboard if I'd not grabbed him.
My apologies. What's up?
My God.
I can only say, sir.
It's all over me.
It's only your oil skin, sir. They'll wash off.
Is that Connie, sir? Come below!
Yes! Forgive me, sir. Hold on! Oh. There you are, sir. The sea's cleaned him off you just as he threw him in your arms.
Is he back below?
I think so, sir.
Though the water stung my face, it put me in a good humour. Philosophy and religion, what are they when the wind blows and the water gets up in lumps? Our huge old ship, with her few and shortened sails from which the rain cascaded, was shouldering the waves at an angle like a bully forcing through a dense crowd. And I was learning to ride her.
Out of these oilskins, Wheeler, and bring me a lamp.
Can't bring you a lamp.
That's it, man. Don't argue. Do what I tell you.
No, sir. Lamps is dangerous to all of us, sir. Since once they are over sick, there's no controlling them. You can have a candle, sir, if you care to pay. A candle douses itself when it falls. I have some candles, sir, if you require them.
Give me a candle, then. I want to write my journal.
There is far too much I don't know yet about the ship, about Wheeler, and my fellow passengers. But I shall make it my business to find out. The third day has passed with even worse weather than the others. The lobby streams with seawater and other fouler liquids, which find their way in under the batten on which the bottom of the door is supposed to close. Nothing fits, of course. If it did, what would happen when this confounded vessel changes her position from savaging the summit of a roller to plunging into the gulf on the other side of it? It is what Wheeler means by rendering like an old boot. When, this morning, I had fought my way along the heaving and sloping lobby to the dining saloon, hoping to find a hot drink there, after fighting my way in, and being disappointed, the door jammed, and I was unable to fight my way out. Then it opened in a rush, threw me across the floor, and could have killed me. Fortunately, one of the officers, tilting his way along the deck like a clown, saw the event.
Mrs. Norwood, are you all right, sir?
Yes, I think I am.
Mr. Gummerton, sir, at your service. Sit yourself down for a minute, sir. Get your breath.
I think I am relatively undamaged, Mr. Gummerton.
Will you take a glass of ale with me, sir?
Thank you.
Two glasses of ale, Bates, for Mr. Talbot and Mr. Cumbersham.
Right you are, sir.
Cumbersham holds the King's Commission and is therefore to be considered a gentleman, though he sucks his ale with as nauseating an indifference to polite usage as a carter. He is 40, with black hair cut short and with a great slash across his head, so he is doubtless one of our heroes.
There you are, sir. Put the heart back in here.
Thank you.
I think the passengers who stayed in their bunks this morning are wise, sir. We have no surgeon aboard, and a broken limb could be a nuisance to all.
Why not?
Oh, none of them will come, sir. Even the most inept young sawbones can do better for himself ashore.
In that case, we can expect an unusual incidence of mortality. It's fortunate we have a chaplain.
A chaplain, sir? We have no chaplain.
And believe me, I've seen him.
No, sir.
The law requires one aboard every ship of the line, does it not?
Captain Anderson would wish to avoid it. And since parsons are in as short supply as surgeons, it is as easy to avoid the one as it is difficult to procure the other.
Come, come, Mr. Cumbersham, are not seamen notoriously superstitious? Do they not require occasional mumbo-jumbo?
Captain Anderson does not, sir. Nor did the great Captain Cook. He was a notable atheist and would as soon have taken the plague into his ship.
God.
I assure you, sir.
But, my dear Mr. Cumbersham, how is order to be maintained? You take away the keystone and the whole arch falls.
Sir?
Oh, your crew is not all officers. Forward, there is a crowd of individuals on whose obedience the order of the whole voyage depends.
They are well enough.
But without the National Church, sir, with a whip in one hand and, dare I say, the illusory prize in the other.
I don't know about all that, sir. Captain Anderson would not have a chaplain in the ship, even if one was on offer. The fellow you saw was a passenger, a very new-hatched parson, I believe.
You may be right. He's certainly a very new-hatched seaman.
That may be so.
I must make myself known to the captain at some convenient time.
I'm not so sure about that, sir.
Not so sure? Do you know who I am, sir?
Well, Mr. Talbot.
I am the godson of Lord Talbot, and I sail to join His Excellency, his brother, at Sydney Cove.
Ah, well, sir, I'm sure that's a different matter altogether. I must own, Mr. Talbot, between ourselves, I have never been on such a ship or such a voyage. We are a ship of war, a store ship, a packet boat, a passenger vessel. And what does that add up to? I know one thing. She'll moor for good at the end of this voyage. Take her topmast down and be a sop to the governor's dignity, firing nothing but salutes, which, Mr. Talbot, is just as well.
Take me with you, sir.
Well, God knows what would happen to her if she was to fire the few great guns left in her.
The devil is in it, then.
I beg you will not repeat my opinion to the common sort of passenger. We must not alarm them. I've said more than I should.
I was prepared with some philosophy to risk the violence of the enemy, but the dispirited self-defense...
It is war, Mr. Talbot. And peace or war, a ship is always in danger. The only other vessel of our rate to undertake this enormous voyage, a converted warship named, I think, the Guardian, did not complete the journey. Oh, but now I remember... Yes, she ran on an iceberg in the Southern Ocean, so her rate and age was not material.
Well, sir, with such devoted and skillful officers as we are provided for, I'm sure we need fear nothing.
Devoted, sir. Devoted.
I see now I have a bruise coming out. I am scraped and bruised on my larboard hand, if that is the correct nautical term. And I shall follow your first advice. Take food and a glass of brandy, and then... turn in to keep my limbs entire. You will drink with me, sir.
I go on watch, sir. But do you settle your stomach? Oh, one more thing, sir. Have a care of Wheeler's paregoric. It's the very strongest stuff, and as the voyage goes on, the price will increase out of all reason. Steward, a glass of brandy for Mr. Talbot.
As Mr. Cumbersham left to go on watch, feeling how more than attractive the warming qualities of strong drink are at sea, I resolved to avoid addiction to ale, brandy, or Wheeler's paregoric, and to make myself known to the captain. Today the motion of the ship is more easy, I gather because we have turned south and the weather is behind us. I dressed myself with some care so as to make a proper impression and went to climb the ladders, in truth broad as a set of stairs, to the after deck and the quarter deck. Cumbersham was at the wheel with a pustular lad of 14 or 15.
Captain Anderson, allow me to...
Cumbersham, who the devil is this? Have they not read my orders?
Excuse me, sir.
Get off my deck, sir, this minute, or by God...
Sir, I must inform
you... Don't you hear me, sir? Get off my deck! Do you laugh, sir?
No, I cannot take a man's anger quite seriously, sir, when we must both keep one leg stiff while flexing the other to avoid falling over.
That is an ignorant remark, sir. Now, will you get off my deck?
Captain, I am the godson of my Lord Talbot. His brother is His Excellency the Governor, whose entourage I sail to join.
Are you indeed? I have the greatest regard for his lordship and would not want to be thought remiss in any attention I might pay to his... I hope you are comfortable, sir. And I must make you aware that the rule is that passengers come to the quarterdeck only by the captain's invitation. Though, sir, in your case, I hope to see more of you.
And then, with a glare like a wolfhound, he stamped off to the stern rail. So I have learned one thing this morning. However invincible our navy may be, a ship of war is an ignoble despotism.
Well, Mr. Cumbersham, I am learning all kinds of sea law with great rapidity.
I can't speak to you now, sir.
Well, then can you show me more of the ship? Or lend me this young fellow?
Mr. Midshipman Willis, sir. He can show you anything you want to see.
Aye, aye, sir.
Come then, Mr. Willis. Let us leave the sacred precinct.
And do not omit to invite Mr. Talbot to glance at the captain's standing orders, Mr. Willis. And tell me any suggestions he has for their improvement.
Well, Mr. Willis, we are certainly in Homer's kingdom.
Are we, sir?
Ep eurea nota thalasses. On the broad back of the sea.
I don't know French, sir.
What do you know, then, lad?
The rigging, sir. Parts of the ship, bends and hitches, how to shoot the sun.
Oh, we're in good hands, I see.
And the parts of the gun, sir, the composition of powder to sweeten the bilge and the articles of war.
And we must not sweeten the articles of war, sir. And what is the composition of powder that enables you to shoot the sun? You must be careful not to give it such a broadside that you put it out.
You're roasting me, sir. Even a landlubber, I ask your pardon, knows what shooting the sun is.
I forgive you that even. When shall I see you do, sir?
Why, at noon, in a few minutes. You must wait for the sun to climb up the sky. We'll measure the angle when it is greatest and take time, too.
You're taking us back to the Middle Ages. You'll be quoting Ptolemy next.
I don't know about him, sir, but we must wait while the sun climbs up.
That is no more than apparent movement. The Earth goes round the sun. The motion was described by Copernicus and confirmed by Kepler.
Sir, I don't know how the sun may behave among those gentlemen ashore, but I know climbs up the sky in the Royal Navy.
And a few moments later, there they were, both the midshipmen and the officers on the quarterdeck, waiting on the sun with brass triangles held to their faces. And all the people who were on deck, some of the common emigrants too, turned and watched this rite with silent awe. They could not be expected to understand the mathematics of the operation. And yet there was a moving pathos about their attention, as in a dog that watches a conversation it cannot possibly understand. I am not, as your lordship must be aware, a friend to those who approve the outrageous follies of democracy. But at that moment, I came near to understanding such concepts as duty, privilege, and authority in a new light.
This is my fellow midshipman, sir, Mr. Tommy Taylor.
How old are you, Mr. Taylor, if it is not impertinent to ask such a question of a gentleman?
13, sir.
And what can you tell me?
Anything you'd like to know, sir. All the passengers accommodated are, and the common people for it, should you be interested in such sights.
So who lodges with me aft?
Well, there's Mr. Oldmeadow, the army man, and Mr. Prettyman.
I know about Mr. Prettyman.
And Miss Granham, who keeps herself to herself. And Mr. Brocklebank, the painter, and his wife and daughter. She's a regular snorter, sir.
And is that the clearest description you can give of her?
Can't think of a better, sir.
Indeed.
Oh, and here comes the parson, sir, out from the lobby. I believe you know about him.
I do. He spewed all over me.
And into his own face, sir. Can you stick into the wind?
Your servant, sir.
If you would excuse me.
The sickly pallor of his smile and the servility of his reverence called forth by nothing more than my gentlemanly attire could not but disgust me.
I do believe the sky pilot's going up to the quarterdeck. If he does, the captain will blow him out of the water.
Has he not read the captain's standing orders? He'll be keelhauled.
Keelhauling a parson? That'd be good.
Get up at once, Captain Anderson.
Lads, the transaction is private to Captain Anderson and the parson. Let us get out of here shortly.
I do not ask for an apology. Your apology is a matter of indifference to me.
We were scarcely back in the lobby when the parson came clattering back down the ladder and passed us, with open mouth and staring eyes from which tears were about to start.
Pray excuse me.
His hutch was opposite mine. He fumbled his way through the door and bolted it on the other side.
Allow me to tell you, Mr. Taylor, Mr. Willis, that a gentleman does not rejoice at the misfortunes of others in public. You may make your bows and be off.
Lord, yes, sir.
Yes, sir, Mr. Silver.
Won't the captain aid the parson above anything?
Wheeler!
Yes, sir.
Come into my cab and get my boots off.
Yes, sir.
Tell me, why does Captain Anderson so dislike a parson?
A little higher, if you please, sir. Now the other one, sir.
Wheeler?
I'm sure I can't say, sir. Does he, sir?
I know he does. The whole ship heard him.
We don't usually have parsons in the Navy, sir. I'll give these a brush. And now the coach, sir.
And Mr. Cumbersham told me he has a strong antipathy to the cloth.
Yes, sir.
Is it not, sir?
I know nothing about it, sir. May I bring you another draft of the pedagogic, sir? I believe you found it really sick.
No, thank you. We don't.
It is rather strong, sir. As Mr. Cumbersham no doubt told you.
Who is it?
Bates, Mr. Talbot, sir.
Come in.
Mr. Summers' compliments. Would Mr. Talbot take a glass of wine with him in the saloon?
Mr. Summers?
The first lieutenant, sir.
Tell Mr. Summers I shall be happy to wait on him in 10 minutes' time.
Yes, sir.
Well, Wheeler, it may not be the captain, but it is the next best thing. We are beginning to move in society.
Thank you.
I proceeded to the passenger saloon, only to find that the invitation had been extended to every passenger in this part of the vessel, and was a short preliminary to dinner.
Mr. Edmund Talbot.
Ah, Mr. Talbot. I'm very glad to see you.
Mr. Sellers, I presume.
Indeed, yes. And this is my brother, Officer Lieutenant Deverell.
Honored to make your acquaintance, Mr. Talbot.
This is a social gathering, Mr. Deverell.
Indeed it is, sir. It is customary that the officers should entertain ladies and gentlemen who take a sea voyage.
A custom most pleasingly followed here. We must see more of each other, Mr. Deverell.
I don't doubt we shall, sir. Summers wishes to introduce you to the ladies.
Talk and such games. It is a harmless amusement for very young gentlemen, and a knowledge of the rules at least appropriate in the education of a young lady.
But I've seen cards played in some queer places, ma'am, I can tell you.
As to that, I have no knowledge. But I would expect some acquaintance with, let us say, whist, to be necessary to a young lady, always provided she has the wit to lose prettily.
Miss Branagh, Captain Oldmeadow, let me introduce Mr. Talbot.
I couldn't help hearing part of your conversation, ma'am. I feel inferior in not having much knowledge of the game you speak of, and I hope that sometime in our long voyage I shall have the benefit of your instruction.
Yes, indeed, Mr. Talbot. As you have discovered, I am a governess.
My man, and yours is the most necessary and genteel profession open to a lady. I can't tell you what a dear friend Miss Dobson, old Dobby, as we call her, has been to me and my young brothers. I will swear you are as secure as she in the affectionate friendship of your young ladies and gentlemen.
If that is so, it is the only thing I am secure in. A lady who is the daughter of a late canon of Exeter Cathedral, and who is obliged by circumstance to take up the offer of employment in the Antipodes, may well set that affectionate friendship at a lower level than you do.
My dear madam, I'm sure not.
Talbot, there are one or two others I should like to meet.
Yourself, Captain. I didn't realize there were so many of them.
This is Mr. Brocklebank. He is a painter.
And I could turn a pretty good group of this lot, I reckon. Since, with the exception of my good lady and my gal, I think we're all present.
And the elements in the forecastle would form an admirable background to the composition.
Oh, no, sir. I must not be patronized, other than by the nobility and the gentry.
The emigrants. I would assume be painted for posterity arm in arm with a common sailor.
You must not have me in your picture, then. I was once a common sailor, as you put it.
You, Mr. Summers?
Indeed, I was. I have performed the naval operation known as coming aft through the hawsehole. I was promoted from the lower deck.
Well, Summers, allow me to congratulate you on imitating to perfection the manners and speech of a somewhat higher station than you were born to.
I am grateful to you, sir, for the compliment.
Ladies and gentlemen, pray be seated. Let us sit where we choose. There will be many such occasions on the long voyage ahead of us. Bait, let them strike up our back.
Come, Summers, let us take the opportunity and pleasure of seating Miss Granham between us.
Allow me.
Thank you, Mr. Summers. Tell me, sir, have you sailed into the Southern Ocean before?
I have not.
Seems, Mr. Devil, you must have the pleasure of my conversation.
There's no constraint in that, sir, on my side.
No, sir. The problem is on my right hand, not the left.
Meat is quite excellent.
And of the freshest. One of our cows was injured during the late blow. Our seamen are a courageous, immoral, and hard-drinking lot, but you'd be surprised to see the sentimental tears shed over a cow with a broken leg.
But they seem up to the mark, sir.
Oh, yes, they do well enough.
There are few problems in any society that will not yield to firm but perceptive government.
That is so in a ship, certainly.
In this one, I have seen firmness, but I'm not yet convinced of perception.
Let me put it to you this way, sir. I had wished for a proper ship of the line, not a superannuated third rater with a crew small in number and swept together in a day or two.
But are you not an established body of officers?
We knew each other for no more than a week or two before we sailed. My father could have done better for me. This commission will do my prospects no good at all. Add to that that the war is running down and will soon stop like an unwound clock.
I'm sure you need not fear for your future, sir. You are an ornament to the service. As dinner came to an end, the saloon was as noisy as a public place can well be. Some glass was broken, with shouts of laughter and some oaths, and Miss Granham started to her feet. But she had not quite moved from her seat when the door was opened for a lady of quite different appearance. She appeared young, yet richly and frivolously dressed, with a bonnet fallen to the back of her neck to reveal a quantity of golden curls.
Oh, Mr. Brocklebank!
My child!
At last, she has contrived to retain a mouthful of consomme.
My little Zenobia.
My place is free, if another cushion may be brought for Miss Brocklebank.
Oh, Miss Graham! I was relying on you to protect my virtue among so many dangerous gentlemen.
Stop the nonsense, Mike. Your virtue is as safe here as anywhere in the vessel.
Dear Miss Granham, I'm sure your virtue is safe anywhere.
Let me escort you to your cabin.
Thank you, Captain O'Hearn.
Sit by me, child.
It is too bright, Mr. Brocklebank. Pa, by the stern window. I must take the seat vacated by Miss Granham.
She fluttered round the table like a butterfly and is certainly the only tolerable female object in our company. But I cannot rhapsodize. Miss Zenobia is surely approaching her middle years and is defending indifferent charms before they disappear forever.
Miss Brocklebank, I would have you know that I'm an inveterate foe to all superstition.
It was a thoughtless action, Mr. Prettyman, a trifle, a mere custom. I would be the last person to offend susceptibilities, sir.
I saw it clearly, sir. You threw salt over your left shoulder.
I confess I did, sir. I will try not to spill the salt again.
Angry, Mr. Prettyman, is Mr. Talbot. I declare that when he is roused, he is quite terrifying.
Anything less terrifying than the absurd social philosopher I am set to observe would be difficult to imagine. At that moment, I was more concerned with Miss Zenobia's large and serious eyes, looking up at me from underneath lashes that were not unassisted.
I must confess to some superstition. I am accustomed to touch wood, and my lucky number is 25.
The size, the scale of the young lady was too grand. She had perhaps been an habitué of the theatre, if not a performer there.
For instance, in the late blow, I touched every piece of wood I could find.
The whole ship, madam.
Her performance was directed not just to her immediate neighbours, but to every man in the room. And it had its effect.
The fact is, it comes from the papistical habit of adoring the crucifix and kissing it.
My old nurse had a horror of crossed knives and of a loaf turned upside down as a presage of disaster at sea.
Mr. Summers, keep an eye to the position of the bread.
You need fear nothing, ma'am, I assure you. The French are quite beaten down by now.
But the French? In my cabin at night, the thought of them is quite terrifying. Knowing we are alone, alone, all alone, alone on a wide, wide sea.
Ah, the ancient Mariner,
ma'am. Yes, sir. I have met Mr. Coleridge. How strange it is.
God save the ancient Mariner from the fiends that plague thee thus. Why look'st thou so? With my crossbow, I shot the albatross.
How a man of reason can attend to such a poem, I cannot imagine. Disasters at sea do not come about by shooting an albatross.
Well, I would not do so, sir, in any circumstances. I'm a peaceable person, Mr. Prettyman, and I will shoot you with as much pleasure.
Have you a gun, sir? I will shoot an albatross, sir, and the sailors will see what befalls.
I have a gun, sir. Are you a marksman?
I have never fired a shot in my life.
Permit me then, sir. I have the weapon in my cabin. You may use it.
Thank you, sir. I will, sir. And you shall see, sir. And the common sailors shall see, too, sir. If you will all be so good as to excuse me.
Pa is determined we shall be protected, you see, in the Antipodes.
He will not go among the natives,
surely. He has some thought of introducing the art of portraiture among them. He owns, though, that a black face will present a special kind of difficulty.
It would be dangerous, I think. Nor would the governor allow it.
If a clergyman may go.
Yes, where is he,
devil?
The parson keeps his cabin. We shall see little of him, I think. And I thank God and the captain for that. I do not miss him. Nor do you, I imagine.
I had forgot clean about him. Oh, Deverell, must you leave us?
I go on watch. You and Miss Brocklebank will no doubt be able to entertain each other.
Thank you. It is now the 12th day, and as your lordship will see, I have not been as attentive to this journal as I would wish. We have had bad weather again, and the motion of the ship has added to a severe colic, which I trace to the feast we made of the late and unlamented Bessie, and which has kept me in my bunk. Prettyman now parades the afterdeck just above my head with Brocklebank's blunderbuss determined to shoot an albatross, and the following encounter was clearly audible through the deckhead.
Mr. Thomas, sir!
Yes, Mr. Prettyman.
I hear the captain has refused the Reverend Mr. Colley permission to conduct services and forbidden him the quarterdeck.
That is true, sir.
The man is an outrageous and petty tyrant.
The quarterdeck is the captain's prerogative, sir.
But the practice of religion is not. I am no friend to the church, sir, but I am a friend to liberty.
Do not disturb yourself, Mr. Prettyman.
A man cannot help but be disturbed, Mr. Granham, when his sense of natural justice is outraged.
That is an admirable sentiment.
Then they moved away, and I heard no more. But I instantly felt that both duty and inclination urged me to act. Who is this brooding tyrant to dictate to me whether I shall have a service to attend or not? So I crossed the lobby to the parson's hutch.
Mr.
James Colley, Mr. Talbot, sir. The Reverend Robert James Colley at your service.
Service is the word, sir.
Sir?
Mr. Colley, when is the Sabbath?
Why, today, sir, Mr. Talbot, sir.
I have been indisposed, Mr. Colley, otherwise I would have made the suggestion sooner. A few ladies and gentlemen would welcome it if you was to conduct a service, a short service, in the passenger saloon at 7 bells in the afternoon, or if you prefer to remain a landsman, at 3:30.
Mr. Talbot, sir, this is... It is like you.
The man disgusts me more than I can say, looking up at me with such obsequious and devoted humility as if I had a brace of livings in my coat pocket. How does he know what is like me? However, the matter had to be proceeded with, so I went to the saloon.
Summers!
Mr. Talbot!
I've arranged that Mr. Colley shall conduct a short service here at 7 bells. I trust you will invite the captain to attend.
It will be my duty to inform him, sir. May I suggest a later hour?
The hour is a matter of indifference to me.
I shall also make so bold as to suggest that the request has come from all the passengers, sir. That would be more conformable to the customs of the sea service.
By all means, sir. I would not want to overturn established custom. I have never so quickly regretted an altruistic action. The service was a grotesque disaster, a display of painted theatrical piety from Miss Brocklebank and crudely obsequious sanctity from Colley, to a pinchbeck congregation which included only Mr. Summers of the officers and was at least half composed of a ragbag of common emigrants, so that for a gentleman the performance was hardly to be endured. The whole thing was tawdry in the extreme, and I repented having any part in it. But the grotesque climax came when I was sick again back in my bunk, and barely conscious from a stiff dose of Wheeler's Paragonic. Oh, there.
It is I, Mr. Talbot. Mr. Colley. Sir, do you remember the Reverend Mr. Colley at your service? It is part of my duty...
Leave me, I beg you, Mr. Colley.
To visit the sink, sir.
I am at prayer. That inspired reply was perhaps the only thing that could have saved me from his visitation. But later, when I had sunk even further into the depths of Wheeler's opium, I do have some indistinct memory of opening my eyes in stupor and seeing that curious assemblage of features, that oddity of nature, Collie's face, hanging over me like a fractured moon in a pool. But now I'm up again and somewhat recovered, he will surely not have the impertinence to thrust himself upon me any further. We have now been steadily blown south of the Mediterranean. The weather has become humid, And if I am to confess all to your lordship, I must tell you about Zenobia. I have to admit the woman is most damnably attractive, paint and all. We have met again and again. How should we not? It is all madness, a tropical delirium. Standing by the bulwarks in the tropic night, stars caught among the sails and swaying very gently all together, I find my voice vibrates with her name. And she, why, she heaves her scarcely covered bosom with more motion than stirs the glossy deep. It is folly, of course, but I am but a young fellow, and the only problem, devil take it, is a place of assignation. Every movement is audible in our hutches. When Brocklebank breaks wind, as he does every morning at 7 bells, the whole ship hears it. In desperation, I have got Mr. Tommy Taylor to take me down to investigate the gun room, where the gunner and the carpenter sat behind a table and watched me like a couple of ship's elders with a knowing smile.
Good God, Mr. Taylor, what's this extraordinary plant climbing up by the ladder?
Well, that belongs to Mr. Willis, sir. Mr. Devril gave it to him.
It has no leaves at all. What's it for?
That's Gentleman Jack, that is. Mr. Devril's joke. Always one for a joke, he is. Mr. Devril told Mr. Willis it was the way to get on in the Navy.
He's a creeper, you see.
Calm yourself, Mr. Taylor, or we'll have a paroxysm.
I couldn't help laughing myself. God knows what sort of a lark Mr. Devril will get up to in the badger bag.
What? Will you take an observation for a glass, Mr. Talbot? A little rum?
I will, sir, in this heat. The air is confoundedly close, gentlemen. What are you going to endure it day after day?
Oh, it's a hard life, Mr. Talbot. Here today, gone tomorrow.
Here today, gone today. Do you mind that young fellow, Hawthorne? Only just come aboard. A bosun gets him the tail on a rope. Last man, like. And he says, don't you let go, whatever happens. So, the boat begins to take charge on the yard, and of course, all the rest jumps clear. The young Hawthorne, who don't know the crown of a block from his arse, he's just come off a farm, I shouldn't wonder. He holds on, like he's been told.
By his orders.
He does.
And what happened?
Why, see, the tail of the rope runs up to the block. Just like that. With the young Hawthorne on the end of it. He must have gone a mile.
Never saw him again.
Good God.
Another glass, Mr. Talbot?
I don't think so, gentlemen. It's really so stuffy in here.
You remember them gals, Mr. Gibbs? Oh. Couldn't we have a winter boatman? I've come over queer-like.
You come along this way, my little dear. This is the way for fresh air.
Oh, Mr. Gibbs, was that a rat?
Oh, just my little doggy, my dear. You feel my little doggy.
And commerce can be obtained even in such a vessel as this. Did no one see you?
Yeah, I saw them. Ah.
I made my way through the bowels of the ship, even past the stinking gravel and sand ballast, and came out gasping for fresh air. Clearly, however freely the warrant officers obtained the favours of young women in these shadowy depths, it was of no use for your humble servant. But I could not help wondering what was meant by the expression badger bag. Then suddenly, the ship presented me with an unexpected opportunity. Dinner had just finished in the saloon.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am happy to inform you that this evening there is to be a customary entertainment for all the ship's passengers, to be performed by members of the ship's company.
What sort of entertainment, sir?
I would not spoil the pleasure, sir, by revealing it.
No pleasure like a good play, is there?
So, if you would all be so good as to assemble upon the after deck and the quarter deck in the next quarter of an hour, the festivities can begin.
Come on, Pat. Let's be sure of a good point of vantage.
Oh, don't hurry me, child. My digestion will take its own time, or there will be hell to pay.
Will you join us, Mr. Talbot, for this mysterious performance?
To be frank with you, madam, such trivial affairs as a seaman's entertainment hold no great attraction for me. And I have a headache, so I think I shall pass the time in my cabin.
Ah, then I hope I shall see you later, sir.
I hope so, too. I felt sure our eyes had communicated, even if our speech had been no more than a cloak thrown over our intentions. So I made my way to my hatch and waited patiently, while all the passengers trooped up onto the decks. Then, when the lobby was quite empty and silent...
Why, Miss Zenobia?
I came back to get my shawl, sir, against the tropic night.
In here, madam, quickly. There's no time to waste, madam. My passion is quite as urgent as I don't doubt yours is.
Mr. Talbot, can I have some respect?
It's time to yield, madam, before they all return.
Oh, sir, take some care.
How can I put what followed decently for your lordship? We flamed together in that narrow space. The hoop of the wash basin collapsed. My books fell to the floor beneath our feet, but we disregarded them. She maintained the pretense of a brave resistance that fired me even more. But I stormed all her defenses, tore down her topsails, and at last she yielded up all the tenderest spoils of war. What was happening above our heads, I had scarcely an idea her abandonment was so complete. But then...
Oh, Mr. Talbot! The French! Save me!
Take her, madam!
Was there ever anything more mistimed and ridiculous? It had been my intention that I should enjoy the passions of Venus without inflicting the pains of Lucina. But like most handsome and passionate women, she is a fool, and her sudden movement put her in the peril from which it had been my generous intention to protect her. Well, the fault was hers, and she must bear the penalties of her follies as well as the pleasures.
Edmund.
Calm yourself, my dear. It was not an enemy attack, but Mr. Prettyman discharging your father's blunderbuss. He has no doubt seen an albatross.
Oh, sir, I fear...
He will not be ravished by the French, but by our common people if they find out what he's doing. And now, my dear, we must get you back to the social scene. It will not do for us to appear together.
Oh,
what's the matter?
You will not disturb me.
Do you suppose I can step overboard into a ship of my own?
It is cruel. You know what I'm referring to. The circumstance not being exactly as it should.
My dear, I am sure you will not pretend that these are circumstances, even to our somewhat inelegant posture, with which you are not wholly familiar.
It is not the circumstances of our posture I refer to. What shall I do?
The danger is slight, as you know very well. Or are you waiting for...
Waiting for what?
For a reasonable moment to step into your hatch, your cabin, I should say, to prepare your toilette.
Edmund!
It's very little time, Miss Bucklebank.
If there should be unhappy consequences...
Why, my dear, we shall cross that bridge when you come to it. Now, go! Go! I shall examine the bucket. Yes, the coast is clear.
Really, the woman is such a fool. The French, indeed. It is her sense of theatre that has betrayed her. I cleared up the wreckage of my cabin while the festivities still seemed to be in progress above me. Then I prepared to find the right moment to go to the saloon. I waited for some time, but still no one descended from the upper decks. So I stole along to the saloon and was disconcerted to find Deverell drinking alone with a carnival mask in his hand and laughing to himself.
Ah, Talbot, my dear fellow. A glass from Mr. Talbot, steward. Oh, what a sight it was. What famous sport.
Yes, famous as you say that.
How he does... Lo, the parson.
Referred to our gallant captain.
Our old rumble gut.
And the same, Mr. Devil, that I'm no particular friend to the cloth myself, but the captain's dislike seems beyond anything. I've been told he's forbidden Mr. Collie the quarterdeck on account of some trivial oversight.
Which Collie supposes includes the afterdeck, so he is confined more or less to the ways.
Such passionate detestation is mysterious. Mm. I myself found Collie to be... I would not punish a man for his nature other than to ignore him.
Bates, another brandy for Mr. Talbot.
You are kindness itself, Talbot. I could tell you...
Tell me what?
Talbot, this is a happy ship. Our captain, our damned captain.
Mr. Bates.
It's all right, Mr. Talbot. Don't you worry, sir. It's not the first time Mr. Deverell's drunk more brandy.
He's got a thing. They appear to be coming down to the deck, so if you'll excuse me.
No,
I'm Mr. Brocklebank.
It's not diverting, Mr. Talbot.
Miss Brocklebank, I have never been better entertained.
I returned to my cabin, where it seemed the woman's perfume still lingered. And I felt a kind of universal sadness. Good God, is Aristotle right about commerce between the sexes, too? The farmyard transaction whereby our species is dragged into the light. I have had a positively Shakespearean idea. The warmth with which Collie and La Brocklebank acted their roles toward each other in the service. Might one not contrive to bring them together, like Beatrice and Benedict? I shall, for the future, single out Mr. Collie for the most distinguished attentions on my part. At least till Miss Brocklebank proves to be no longer in danger from the French. I awoke next morning with a brandy headache and went out on deck to blow it away.
Morning, Mr. Prettyman.
Good morning, sir.
You hit the albatross last night, sir?
I did not, sir. The weapon was snatched from my hands. The whole episode was grotesque and lamentable. Such a display of ignorance and superstition.
No doubt, no doubt. Such a thing could never happen in France.
Not in any reasonable country, sir.
Then, to my amazement, I saw Collie, in round wig, tricorn and black coat, on the quarterdeck with Captain Anderson, who turned to the rail as I came to the ladder and spat over the side, red-faced and grim as a gargoyle. Whereupon Collie lifted his hat and returned towards the ladder.
Mr. Summers, I believe it was you who discharged Mr. Brocklebank's weapon.
It was, sir.
I trust you injured no one.
I fired over the side, sir.
I must thank you for it.
It was nothing, sir. Mr. Collie.
Well, sir.
I beg of you, be advised by me.
In what way, sir?
Do not go immediately. We have not known our people long enough. After yesterday, I am aware that you are no friend to intoxicants of any sort. I beg you to wait till the people have been issued with their rum. After that, there will be a period when, even if they are no more open to reason, they will be calmer and more amiable.
I have armor, sir.
Believe me, I know of what I speak. I was once of their condition.
I bear the shield of the Lord.
Sir, Mr. Collie, as a personal favor to me, since you declare yourself indebted, I beg of you, wait for 1 hour.
Very well, sir. I accept your advice. Your servant, Mr. Talbot.
Mr. Collie.
Sir?
I have long desired to be better acquainted with you, but owing to an unfortunate indisposition, the occasion has not presented itself. Will you not take a turn with me on deck?
Mr. Talbot, sir. Words cannot... I've long desired you, but at such a moment... This is worthy of you and your noble patron. This is... Christian charity in its truest meaning. God bless you, Mr. Talbot.
I swear, tears stood in his eyes. His Adam's apple positively danced up and down. Then he retired a yard or two, bowing, and disappeared through the lobby and into his hutch. Something has happened on this ship. Yesterday, while I was so closely engaged with the delicious enemy in my cabin, Summers discharged Prettyman's blunderbuss for no apparent reason. Devril was drunk, with a mask in his hand. And Collie seems more effusively grateful than usual that I should even speak to him. Something has happened, and I don't know what it is. But it is something to do with the Reverend Robert James Collie.
In episode 1 of Rites of Passage by William Golding, Talbot was played by Samuel West, Parson Collie by Simon Russell Beale, and Captain Anderson by Kenneth Haig. Lieutenant Summers was Barnaby Kay, Cumbersham, Struan Roger, Deverell, Roger May, Wheeler, Weeks, John Grillo, Brocklebank, George Mercell, Zenobia, Lucy Tregear, Miss Granham, Alison Skilbeck, Prettyman, Phillips and the Carpenter, Max Digby, Bates, Old Meadow and the Gunner, Charles Edwards, Mr. Willis, Thomas Mayer, and Mr. Taylor, Julian Morris. Rites of Passage was adapted for radio and directed by Don Taylor and was an independent production by First Rights Radio for BBC Radio 4.